You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jessica Toku Ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapare Thursday, our second to last week of The Wire for the year. My name is Jessica and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour and I'm also joined by producer Beth in the studio. E whai akine coming up on the show, news team member Faith speaks to Professor of Māori Studies at the University of Auckland, Margaret Mutu, te rawa Ngāti Whātua, about why she believes Te Papa should remove its display of the English version of the Treaty of Waitangi, which claims Māori ceded sovereignty. I speak to Head of Marketing and Communications at Tautiaki Moana, Coast Guard New Zealand, Kimberly Waters, about the importance of wearing a life jacket. And I also talk to lecturer at the University of Auckland Law School, Dr. Anna Broadmoor, about her research into how we can better legally protect people's reproductive choices. Beth, what have you got for us today?
For city councilling this week, I speak to councillor for Waitakere, Shane Henderson, about Auckland Council's decision not to support the building of a second Waitemata Harbour crossing and the council's spending of $7.4 million on recruitment in the past 12 months. I also speak to musician and surgeon Dr. Anantha Narayana of the Faculty of Medical and Health Sciences at the University of Auckland about the impact of music during surgery.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So get in touch, tuku patuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rane. Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka oe e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kororo anohi pakihiri roki roki mā runga i te pai, tuku tuku o irirangi poho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. And you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the website 95BFM.com under Bcasts.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Councilling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland Council has made the decision not to support the building of a second Waitemata Harbour crossing, which would cost $56 billion and involve the construction of two underwater tunnels and light rail connecting the North Shore to the CBD. And in the past 12 months, Auckland Council has spent $7.4 million on recruitment. I spoke to Councillor for Waitakere, Shane Henderson, about these decisions. Here is that interview.
Plans by the previous government to build a second Waitemata crossing have been rejected by Auckland Council. What is the thinking behind this decision?
Yeah, I think it was a pretty big move, a pretty momentous occasion for the city to say, look, we're rejecting what would essentially be a mega project, a second harbour, third harbour crossing, when you count the Greenhithe Bridge over the Waitemata Harbour. The reasoning is quite simple. We found that it was just significantly too unaffordable. It was an extremely expensive project. And there were some value for money issues. And, you know, we said, look, we need to look at lower cost alternatives to move to the North Shore in greater number and look at how we can support things like active modes and rapid public transport, those kind of things. What can we do there? So back to the drawing board a little bit. But, you know, we can't justify such a huge project. And when you look at kind of embedded carbon, that's another factor there as well.
Is the council thinking of alternatives to the original plan?
Yeah, as I sort of alluded to, there's a couple of things that we're looking at, but I think we're still fairly open to different ideas and different thoughts around what we can do instead that might be a little bit less expensive. So things like, you know, the resilience of the bridge is a really important factor, but looking at how we can get, for example, bikes and active modes across the other side, that's a really important factor in all of this. Looking at, you know, any extensions to the busway or anything like that, we're kind of an open book at the moment, but it's just got to be cheaper.
Was the decision to reject the plan more popular than to keep it?
Yeah, in terms of popularity, I suppose it does depend a little bit on who you ask. I should hope that the residents of the North Shore will have some sympathy for trying to keep costs low as much as we can. And also at the same time, you know, we're not forgetting about that area. We still need to work on what we can do to make things better for transport there. In large parts of the city, particularly in the ward that I represent, I think that would be a fairly popular move because, look, we have needs all across Auckland in terms of particularly the public transport network that demand attention. For example, the Northwest Corridor, where we have an interim busway that's working very well, but it is very interim, right? And that's just one example. So we've got to look at things as a citywide approach. I think people are fairly on board with that approach too.
In the past 12 months, Auckland Council has spent $7.4 million on recruitment. Does the council see this expense as necessary to its recruitment process?
Yeah, look, I think this came out in the media recently and I think Mayor Brown was very scathing of it. And look, I'd say, firstly, I support Wayne Brown's sentiment there on this. When we're looking at kind of value for money initiatives, trying to keep costs down, that's exactly the kind of space we need to be in right now. And also kind of making the most of what we have, all of those kind of things. That's so important now more than ever. But at the same time, we do need to put that figure in context. For example, look, nearly all of our recruitment is an internal process. So rather than outsourcing, we save significant amounts of money doing it ourselves. And that's kind of something we might want to think about for other council services just quietly. But, you know, council's a big organisation. 7.4 million is the group cost, so it includes Auckland Transport, includes water care, all that kind of stuff. You know, it is a large and a complex organisation that needs to maintain the services for Auckland. So there are kind of two sides to the situation, but I do agree with the sentiment of trying to keep costs down.
That was Councillor for Waitakere, Shane Henderson, speaking to me about Auckland Council's decision not to support the building of a second Waitemata Harbour crossing, as well as the council's spending of $7.4 million on recruitment in the past 12 months.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Advocates are calling for Te Papa Museum to remove its display of the English version of the Treaty of Waitangi, which claims Māori ceded sovereignty. This comes after protesters defaced the museum's treaty exhibition this week, calling for the English text to be removed. Faith spoke to Professor of Māori Studies at the University of Auckland, Margaret Mutu, Te Rarawa Ngāti Whātua, about the importance of centering the Māori text Te Tiriti, which reflects what Rangatira signed. Here is that interview.
So first of all, what do you think are the most significant differences between the English and Māori versions of Te Tiriti?
They are two quite completely quite different documents. Te Tiriti was about confirming that the country was under the control and authority of Māori, of the hapū, in fact. And all the treaty was put in place for was to allow British immigration, but it had to be on the condition that Pākehās stopped being lawless. So that's essentially what Te Tiriti or Waitangi is. It's an immigration document. The English draft that Hobson drew up was a treaty of cession of sovereignty, where Māori would cede their sovereignty to the Crown. And it really wasn't anything else other than that. Now, the important thing about that second document was that it was never discussed, it was never signed, and in fact, belongs in a rubbish bin. You know, it's a draft. And it's a draft that never saw the light of day. And yet it just says something about the nature of the man, William Hobson, that he then used it to try and say, well, this is what Māori signed. And it's just a lie. Yeah, as far as I've always been brought up with the fact that my ancestors signed Te Tiriti or Waitangi, they didn't speak English, they didn't understand English, they didn't read English, and the country was entirely Māori at that time. There were a few Pākehās here, but it was a Māori country. So why would you even think that Māori would want to give up control, give up their absolute and paramount authority, their mana, to somebody who lived on the other side of the world they'd never met? It's just a ridiculous assumption to make. It's also ridiculous because of the sheer numbers that were here. You know, hundreds of thousands of Māori to, at most, a couple of thousand Pākehā living in one isolated area in the north. It just doesn't make any sense, but it's been convenient for Pākehās to say, oh, no, 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 Māori ceded sovereignty. We didn't.
And would you like to elaborate on why the Māori version should be acknowledged and displayed in places like Te Papa as opposed to the English version?
So the Māori version is the only treaty that this country has, and therefore my understanding is that it is there in Te Papa. So it is, or a blown-up version of it is there in Te Papa. It is the only version that should be talked about. If they need an English language version, of course my hope is always that every New Zealander can speak both languages, but the reality is they can't, then the only thing that should be there in English is an accurate translation of Te Tiriti or Waitangi, not some drafted wish list of William Hobson. It's really irrelevant, that one.
That was Faith speaking to Professor of Māori Studies at the University of Auckland, Margaret Mutu, Te Rārawa Ngāti Whātua, about Te Tiriti.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this quick break. Keep it on the B.
Thank you. foot with a knife in his hand. He plunged it in deep. She looked at him with pleading eyes. He softly spoke, "My dear, the love has died." And then he muffled her desperate cries under the moonlight.
What did Santa bring everybody?
Wow, some undies. Thanks, Santa.
Wow, a Leica M11 monochrome and a range of professional quality lenses. Santa, you're the best.
No, what? Wait, why did you get a better gift?
I asked Santa for it. What did you ask for?
World peace?
Whoops.
Ding dong merrily on high. Find all the photography ding dongs you need to make your Yuletide gay at ProGear. Open now at 3 Railway Street, Newmarket, or go to progear.co.nz.
That big jolly guy. You know, red hat reindeer, appears once a year, gives gifts, then ghosts. Well, turns out he's burnt out, so can't do Auckland Christmas this year. No, it's got nothing to do with the striking elves.
Fair be the elves!
So he's given 95BFM all the gifts to give to one lucky B card holder. That's right, it's
the 95BFM Summer Sorted Super Prize Pack,
featuring
return flights for two to Hawaii,
thanks to Hawaiian Airlines,
a $2,000 voucher for Galbraith's Ale House,
a 09 electric scooter from Freed, proud to be electric,
a $250 voucher for Meze Bar,
an invite to all Madman movie releases of 2024, plus a year's subscription to DocPlay,
a $500 voucher for Pat Menzies shoes,
a summer's worth of Reburger,
a summer's supply of reef oil for you and your mate,
a year's supply of holy CBG hemp oil thanks to Tiger Drops,
two VIP passes to Laneway,
tickets to Splore,
a double pass to Nest Fest,
a summer's worth of Lion's Mane and Cordyceps mushroom capsules from Flow State,
plus heaps more. The 95BFM Summer Sorted Super Prize Pack. Text SUMMER plus your name and B-card number to 5395. More info on B-card signups at 95bfm.com.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95bfm. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395. We'd love to hear from you.
Scientists have finally found the clitoris.
The Wire.
Music is shown to ease pre-surgery nerves of surgeons, as well as improving concentration. I spoke to musician and surgeon Dr. Anantha Narayana, who was writing his PhD on music and surgery. I spoke to him about his studies and findings in this area and whether music helps or hinders in the operating theatre. We also spoke about his experience of playing music growing up, as well as the experiences that culminated in his studying of music and surgery. Here is that interview. So you are a saxophonist. How long have you been playing for, and when did you first think about combining music with surgery?
Yeah, great question. So I started very young in music. So I played recorder when I was 2 or 3 years old. And then as my fingers grew, I started playing the clarinet. And then from about the age of 11, I've been playing the saxophone. And it was very much kind of an interest on the side that my parents encouraged me to play. And I played it right through high school. And then when I was in medical school, I was kind of playing in bars and various groups. And then I finished medical school as a 6-year degree. And then I finished 5 years of it. And a few things happened. Sort of had some friends with mental health crises, a couple of personal life changes, and then also a really positive experience learning music in South India. And those factors culminated in me taking a year away from medical school and studying at the New Zealand School of Music for a year, jazz performance on the saxophone. And that was an incredible year, and you know, credit to my parents at the time, who sort of had faith in me and thought that playing and learning music could sort of help me with resilience in the long term. But I think neither they or I thought that it would turn into quite a long and interesting research journey.
Right.
So it was when I returned to medical school for my final year in Dunedin, I started to take an interest in how music was being used in the operating theatres, and then did a survey at the time. And then since 2020, I've been working on a PhD thesis combining, you know, my interests of surgery, research and music.
What kind of music have you found is most effective for cognition during surgery?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So by and large, most surgeons prefer and play easy listening or pop music. Previous research has found actually is that if a surgeon selects the music themselves, they're more likely to perform better, at least at simulated tasks or like arithmetic tasks. So what we went in to our research with is an idea that surgeon selected music is what we would try and use to see if there's any effect of it, rather than forcing surgeons to listen to particular kinds of music. We weren't sure if that would get through the ethics committee.
Some may argue music may be a distracting force as opposed to a useful one. Does the effect of music change from surgeon to surgeon?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think personal preference and team preference is really important to take into consideration. And generally, surgeons don't like listening to kind of unfamiliar or grating music. Mm. In terms of, I guess, distractibility, certainly the case, and there's some concerns around the impact it can have on communication as well. But by and large, what we found is most surgeons would turn the music down if there's a crisis or an emergency. Similar to, you know, if you're parallel parking or, you know, landing an aeroplane, those kinds of times are quite critical to have effective communication and minimal distraction. But we're finding for longer, more elective operations, it really is preferable.
You mentioned the jazz gap. I read that. Could you explain what that is a little more for us?
Yeah, absolutely. In the very first survey I carried out in a hospital in the South Island, what we found was that there was a percentage of people who wanted to listen to jazz, and I think it was somewhere between 15-20%, and then the percentage of people who actually said that they listened to jazz, which was closer to 5%. And so we noted that there was perhaps 10% of people who wanted to listen to jazz but couldn't or didn't for whatever reason. And as a jazz enjoyer or appreciator, I was quite interested in what kind of why that gap exists, but I probably have to interview a few more people to find that one out.
Do you think music could have a positive impact on surgery on a wide scale?
Yeah, definitely. So it's very common for surgeons to feel stress during operations, and it's similar to if you're in a waiting room prior to an interview, you might feel sort of clammy hands or sweaty skin or feeling like your heart's racing, a feeling of anticipation. And that stress can be born from any number of factors, whether it's the environment or the difficulty of the operation in front of you or personal factors. All of these lend, and music's been shown in many different fields, music therapy for patients, that it can be beneficial to relieve anxiety. So there's a lot of evidence to suggest that there might be help to reduce that stress response, and whether that's a psychological response or a physiological response is yet to be seen. And certainly our surveys have shown that surgeons think it can actually improve their mood and reduce their anxiety and reduce their mental fatigue.
I read also about surgical playlists. What would be on these playlists?
playlists.
Yeah, it was really interesting when I was chatting to Jesse Mulligan on Monday. There were sort of people writing in with various suggestions, like the first cut is the deepest, for example. But by and large, a number of surgeons, particularly ones who have interest in surgery, will have a playlist of their own. Otherwise, we've certainly seen a shift from CDs to using Spotify, for example.
Mm.
And so I think, you know, modern theatre suite design is, you know, should consider taking into account incorporating these kinds of streaming services into the way that a theatre suite is built.
And you'd want to make sure there are no ads either.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
That was musician and surgeon Dr. Anantha Narayana speaking to me about music and surgery.
It upsets me so much that there's still people that we need to convince this is a real fucking thing. Real friggin' thing.
The Wire.
With the number of preventable drownings increasing, Tautiaki Moana Coast Guard New Zealand are reminding people to wear life jackets while on the water this summer with their new campaign, Just Wear It. I spoke to marketing and communications manager Kimberly Waters about why wearing a life jacket is so important when on the water. Here is that interview.
Your name is perfect for your career. Was there any inclination there for you to do a water-based career, or is it just a coincidence?
It's just a coincidence. And funny, you're only one of two people since I started working at Coast Guard that have actually said that. None of my colleagues even thought about that. I do love the water. I love being out on the water. It's quite an apt surname, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you tell us a bit about what Coast Guard volunteers do?
Coast Guard is Aotearoa New Zealand's only water safety, rescue and education organisation, and we have over 2,000 volunteers across the Motu who are dedicated to saving lives on the water. So if you're out on the water and you get in trouble, look, it might be something that's a bit non-urgent, like a mechanical or electrical issue or run out of fuel. So it could be something small like that and you need a tow home, or it could be something a bit more serious where we need full-on search and rescue. And our volunteers are highly skilled and trained in search and rescue.
And something that Coast Guard campaigns for is life jacket usage. So can you talk a little bit about the statistics around New Zealanders and their life jacket usage?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that our Coast Guard whānau are immensely passionate about. This summer we want every Kiwi who goes out on the water to just wear it. It's called a life jacket for a reason, and that's because it can save your life if you end up in the water. And we have seen a real worrying rise in drownings linked to watercraft incidents. And last year, based on the Water Safety Drowning Prevention Report, 21 people who sadly lost their lives in a watercraft incident weren't wearing a life jacket. That's 21 families, whose lives are devastated as a result of that. And, you know, and that's why we need to encourage, people need to be wearing life jackets out there, they are your lifeline out on the water. Last year, of all the drowning fatalities, watercraft was also the highest. So it is a concerning trend for us, which is why we need people to be wearing them out on the water.
What are the current laws around life jacket usage in New Zealand?
Every sort of council has its own rules. And so it's really something that we're trying to do from a Coast Guard perspective is advocate for that change. We want to see people out on the water who go out on the water on vessels 6 metres and under. We want to make it mandatory for them to be wearing life jackets. So at the moment there's a lot around the skipper's responsibility. As I allude to, every council has a different type of bylaw around this, and this is something that we're really wanting to campaign and change. And this is also, and that's, I guess, predominantly focused around boats. But the reality is, whether you're boating, you're kayaking, you're out on a yacht, you're on a stand-up paddleboard, you might be jet skiing, you might be fishing off the rocks. All of those are super fun activities to do out on the water. But amidst the enjoyment of all of those, there is inherent risk when being out on the water. So at the end of the day, we just want everybody who's heading out on the water to wear a life jacket.
And just finally, is there anything else that people can do as well as wearing life jackets to prevent watercraft drownings?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there's just general safety advice. So absolutely, first one being, you know, wear a life jacket. You know, the next one as well is, you know, make sure that you've got two forms of communication when you go out on the water. And, you know, that might be a mobile phone in a waterproof case. Or like a working VHF radio, and that just means that we can communicate with you in an emergency. Always let somebody know where you're going. If you're heading out on the water, particularly on your own, you know, just again, make sure you tell someone where you're going, and you know, to ensure that you have a safe return. And you can even, you know, if you're not letting you know, your friends or family know, then you can also let us know, so you can log a trip report with us, with Coast Guard on our free Coast Guard app, or give us a call. So, you know, really important to let people know that you're heading out. And the other big thing is just probably really around checking the weather conditions. You know, so before you're heading out, you know, just make sure you know what you're heading, you know, what it's doing on the water, what are the tides doing. We know that Mother Nature here in New Zealand can change in an instant. So, and that's quite often when people get into the greatest problem is you know, if the swell picks up or the wind picks up, that's generally when we tend to find, you know, that incidents can kind of start to occur as the weather conditions change.
That was Head of Marketing and Communications at Tautiaki Moana, Coast Guard New Zealand, Kimberly Waters, talking about the importance of wearing a life jacket when on the water.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
We're going to take a quick break, but stay listening to BFM. We'll be back soon.
Take the stress out of Christmas with Tiger Drops Holy CBG Hemp Oil. Plus, you get a free 15ml with every 30ml purchase. That's two Holy CBG Hemp Oils for the price of one.
Tiger Drops are not intended for consumption or for the treatment or prevention of any disease or condition. Sales support judicial review of CBD consumption in New Zealand. For more info, head to tigerdrops.com.
The original
originator.
95. Keep some tricks up your sleeve.
Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
was your voicemail. I'm at the gig and I was thinking about you. I thought that you'd be here. Guess that you don't check the 95 BFM entertainment guide. That's a shame. It's my last night in the city. I'm flying out in the morning, so guess I probably won't see you again.
Oh, there's someone in here.
Don't miss the moment. Check the 95 BFM entertainment guide. It's gigs in there. Online at 95bfm.com and on air 7 days a week.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're listening to 95BFM's news and current affairs show, The Wire. Text in 5395 is the number. Let us know what you think about our pieces today.
You know, alcohol is fuck normal. Sorry, I swore. It's important.
That's okay. It's BFM.
The Wire.
Around the world, people who have had their reproductive choices interfered with, either intentionally or unintentionally, are seeking legal compensation. I spoke to lecturer at the University of Auckland Law School, Dr. Anna Broadmore, about her research into how reproductive control could be recognised as a protected interest within the common law.
So, I mean, what my research is really focused on is reproductive options can include choosing not to reproduce, right? So that can include having a sterilisation operation because you feel very strongly that you don't want children. Now, if that goes wrong and you end up with a child, trying to get compensation for the life disruption can be very difficult. Of course, there's also IVF treatment. So if you want to have a child with your partner but you're struggling with fertility, you can get treatment which can help you conceive a child with your partner. Now, if those gametes are muddled up and you end up having a child with a stranger's genes, then again, you've suffered a significant life disruption. And you can have gametes frozen. So there are cases where people have been undergoing cancer treatment and they have had their sperm frozen because the cancer treatment would destroy their fertility and it might not naturally restore itself. And so they've stored their sperm to kind of preserve the possibility of having a biological child. And then the freezers haven't been properly maintained. So that preserved sperm has been destroyed. And when they haven't recovered their natural fertility, they've lost the chance of having a biological child. So they are, I mean, you know, and obviously there are more and more options, but that's kind of what my research is focused on, these significant reproductive choices we make. And when they are negligently and sometimes intentionally interfered with, the huge life disruption that's suffered and how private law can respond to that, because the people who've suffered these life disruptions want some kind of compensation for it. But private law is struggling to work out how to provide that compensation.
So in New Zealand, currently, what options do people have for compensation if their reproductive options are disrupted?
So, I mean, it's an interesting question. There isn't a great deal of case law on this in New Zealand. So it would be the usual route would be a negligence claim in the courts if it is negligently interfered with. There are, and I think there have been a couple and they've said, oh, because obviously in New Zealand we've got ACC, but except for, I think there's one case where the court said, look, for the pregnancy itself, there could be compensation. But obviously the reproductive choices we make look far beyond a pregnancy. You know, you've got a lifelong relationship and responsibility for a child. So in New Zealand, I guess it would be the same as all these other jurisdictions. You would just make a claim and in negligence and see how the court was willing to respond. Now, so like I say, there haven't really been the cases in New Zealand, but abroad there have been more cases. So there's quite a lot of interesting case law in the United Kingdom and in Canada and in Singapore where people have made these claims in negligence and they have been somewhat successful, but there's a bit of a confusion in how the courts are responding to it. And so really what my research looks at is trying to pull out reproductive control as an interest. So, sorry, just to talk about, you know, how private law works in general, we have these things like our body and our property. If these are intentionally or negligently interfered with, the law responds and provides compensation. And really what I'm looking at is whether we should be drawing reproductive control out and treating it in a similar way to the body and property, so that if it is negligently or intentionally interfered with, we have a clear path to compensation.
What might some of the challenges be about viewing reproductive control this way through the legal system?
So probably one of the big challenges is that it's an intangible interest. So, you know, the body and the property are the two things that are most, you know, the most obvious things that are protected, and they are tangible. You know, a body is, it's there, property is there. Reproductive control is almost, it's a choice, right? So it's like, well, I want to have children, I don't want to have children, I want to have children, but only with this person. I don't want, you know, so I think it's the intangibility of it and having the common law develop to recognise this more intangible interest is the biggest challenge. But we can see that over time, more intangible interests are being recognised by the courts. And so then, you know, for instance, the development of the tort protecting privacy is an example of an intangible interest being recognised in private law.
How do you believe we could better recognise reproductive control in a place like New Zealand or around the world?
Well, essentially, kind of like looking directly at the interest. So in these cases where, just to give you an example of an interesting case, it's the Yearworth decision, where these men had preserved their sperm and then it was damaged and so they couldn't have children. So they ultimately did receive a remedy in that case, but it was only by characterising the sperm as property that they received a remedy. Now, there are problems with that because the nature of the harm they suffered was like a mental harm, right? They were incredibly distressed. Some of them suffered a psychiatric harm because of their lost chance of having a biological child. But property and mental distress don't really go hand in hand. So when someone crashes into your car and they cause you property damage, well, the courts give you, you know, the repair money to repair your car, but it's not normally expected that you would suffer mental distress. It's very difficult to get mental distress damages for property damage. But because they treated the sperm as property, they were the reference points that they were working with. And so, so it meant that it was difficult to access the damages. They weren't speaking directly to the loss. So I think that if we draw reproductive control out of all this case law where it's kind of indirectly being protected and identified as an interest, then when it's interfered with either negligently or intentionally, it will be a more straightforward process to get the compensation that speaks to the nature of the loss.
And can you talk a little bit about why you wanted to do this specific research to make it hopefully more simple for people to get compensation if their reproductive control has been interfered with?
Well, I think it was really a case. Look, it's been an area I've always been interested in, and there's a lot of interesting case law where, you know, IVF is going wrong. It's kind of it's a contemporary problem as biotechnological developments increase the control we can exercise. When that control is lost and you look at how difficult it is to get the compensation and you compare the life disruption suffered when you either have your fertility thwarted or your choice not to have children thwarted, and you compare it to what the private law does respond to. For instance, you know, someone damages your car or they you accidentally break your leg, but it heals, whatever, they negligently crash into you and you break a leg and that heals, etc. But all these things are temporary, right? And they can be fixed. But something like a reproductive choice that you've made has such a profound impact on your life, it seems that there is a mismatch in how private law is responding to it. So, yeah, it was probably that led me to this research. One thing that's interesting about this is that on the whole, you can see that the courts are trying to respond to this kind of, you know, when there's negligent interference. But when there's an intentional interference, there hasn't been this kind of response. So there was a case in Canada where there was a couple who had an intimate relationship, and the woman lied and told the man that she was taking the contraceptive pill. Now, she later admitted this was a lie. She fell pregnant and had a healthy child. And the man then obviously paid child support and had a relationship with the child, but he claimed against the woman to say, well, you know, I wanted to wait to have a child with at the right time with the right person, and you've kind of taken that away from me by lying and causing me not to take my own precautions. And the law said, well, sorry, bad luck. There's no... That's just life. I think it's interesting that once we draw out reproductive control as an interest that should have this protection, that maybe a different outcome would be reached, that maybe you do have to consider other people's reproductive choices when you decide how to act yourself. So, yeah, there are lots of interesting cases around on this issue.
That was lecturer at the University of Auckland Law School, Dr. Anna Broadmoor, about her research into how reproductive control could be recognised as a protected interest within the common law.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That is a wrap on The Wire for Rapare Thursday.
Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Auckland Councillor for Waitakere, Shane Henderson, musician and surgeon, Dr. Inantha Narayana, Professor of Māori Studies at the University of Auckland, Margaret Mutu Te Rawera, Ngāti Whātua, Head of Marketing and Communications at Tautiaki Moana, Coast Guard New Zealand, Kimberly Waters, and lecturer at the University of Auckland Law School, Dr. Anna Broadmoor.
Nī rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Eli.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.